Right Now Politics. Mike Williams and Bridget Morton are our guests. Bridget's in the Wellington studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Mike is in the Auckland studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
Just trying to get your little introductions now. Bridget works in PR. She is with the Wellington firm Franks Ogilvy and is also a former advisor to the... You can finish this. A former education minister, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
In the national government. Thank you very much. Mike is one of those who needs no introduction. Currently president of the Howard League, Mike.
And CEO.
CEO and former president of the Labour Party. Sorry, both of you.
It's all right.
It's sitting on a piece of paper in front of me too. New Zealand First Conference. I don't know that a lot happened, really, but let's talk about New Zealand First and some of the issues that are around it at the moment. First, you get the publicity around your conference. I thought it was a piece of PR masterstroke. I don't know if you agree, Bridget, to have the youth wing have its successful remit go up and some open minds on the party pill testing that NZ First said it was going to oppose, a government proposal it said it was going to oppose. You can't really go wrong having a conference, having TV cameras there, having some publicity.
Yeah, and I think it achieved exactly what they wanted it to. We've seen in the last couple of weeks for New Zealand First, they've had, you know, the leaks and the issue with the president standing down and Clayton Mitchell getting kicked out of a bar in Tauranga. So I think for them, they wanted to look unified, they wanted to look professional, and they wanted to look classic New Zealand First.
Mike?
Well, I thought it was a very successful conference to the extent that I went online and got hold of Winston Peters' speech, which is really well worth reading because he lays out the plan for his party to increase its vote. He defends the position of a centre party in New Zealand politics and what it would actually do. He attacks National repeatedly as being... neoliberal, and particularly Paul Goldsmith. And I was a bit surprised to hear that the media say he didn't announce any policy, because there is policy in this speech about foreign banks, aquaculture, and women in the trades. So it seems to have been a very successful conference, and I think the strategy that the New Zealand First Party is operating is basically the 2002 electoral strategy, where New Zealand First vote hit 10%, and a lot of that was in the provinces when the national vote dropped to 21%. And they're quite explicit about that. And one of the nicest bits is they're going for the politically incorrect vote via Shane Jones, which I had a bit of a chuckle at.
Well, hence some of the stuff that Shane Jones has been doing, and everyone's gone, why doesn't the Prime Minister censure him and whatever? The Prime Minister is helpless, really, to do anything about him, but it's part of the strategy. Talk to me a little bit more about targeting the provinces. 2002, obviously, was an exceptional election because the national vote completely collapsed. At the moment, the latest polls are telling us actually both the major parties are quite strong. It has New Zealand First there or thereabout. And one's assumption, 9 times out of 10, is that New Zealand First will make it. So tell me, though, about the strategy regarding the provinces and growing the vote. Was there an elaboration on that, or is it simply what we're seeing already with the number of measures that New Zealand First has intervened or even watered down Labour ambitions?
Well, it's a bit of both. Certainly, the grow the New Zealand First vote in the provinces has been a strategy since before the last election, and it was quite explicit. The Provincial Growth Fund, which Labor agreed to and I believe National agreed to consider, was probably a key factor in deciding New Zealand First to go with Labor. But no, so I think it's business as usual. They've stuck to a strategy and a policy, and I believe, you know, Matthew Hooton described them as the right-wing faction of the Labour Party. I don't know that Winston would terribly much object to that, but certainly he's saying that unless National changes its way with people like Paul Goldsmith around, who's very strongly identified with Rogernomics, then there's not much chance of going with National. But the interesting thing, the question you just asked, is that The reason the National vote collapsed in 2002 is because the polls said that National couldn't win. So normally National supporters felt free to support ACT, and I think United Future did well in that election too, did they not? And, of course, New Zealand First. Now,
18Ps, rather.
Mm. Yeah, so, you know, whether that situation will occur again where people perceive National as unable to win doesn't look like it at the moment.
Well,
but
they were polling nothing
happen.
Like 40-something percent at the time, though. They were already in trouble, and that just caused the stampede at the end.
Yeah,
I'm interested,
true.
Bridget, in how far they take this business of courting the provincial vote and portraying themselves as a stay on the government's hand. There's some big policies around at the moment. The water one remains. The water bottling already got dealt to. But the wider issues around water policy that the farmers were saying, look, this is far too short a consultation period over. And the other biggie still to come, we've talked about it several times, is the climate policy. That's a question of whether farming comes in at all, is even touched a nick by the trading scheme, the emissions trading scheme. How far is it going to push it with Labor?
Well, I think it's quite interesting, this, you know, focus on the provinces, because one of the things that did come out of the conference over the weekend is Tracy Martin announcing that she's going to run in Ohararu, which is probably one of the most sort of beltway non-provincial seats in the country, and also announcing that there was going to be an influx of particularly female Wellington candidates across Wellington seats. So how does that kind of reflect a province-based strategy? You think if you were going to have a province, you know, focus, and you wanted to put your more high profile, like ministers, you know, in seats where they could win, why would you be running them in Ohararu, where it seems to be a two-way race between Labour and National there?
Are you talking about Ohararu?
Yes.
Okay.
And so I think, I mean, obviously the provinces has been, I don't think that's
formerly Peter Dunn's seat, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think this is as, the province strategy is one that is new for New Zealand First. They've always, you know, the home of the party is turning out.
What they've got at the moment is a part of the electorate that is feeling under pressure, that is feeling unloved. It is feeling like there's been a lot of what is proposed at the moment, for reasons many of them wouldn't disagree with, is putting an unfair and unequal burden on their businesses and their ways of life. Right, and actually, I've gone more rural than provincial here, and there's a difference between those two demographics, but they can overlap. A provincial town will struggle when its rural community is struggling. So there's a willing kind of gap in the market for them in some ways, but the question is, how far will they inhibit some of Labor's policies and legislation coming through in order to attract that vote?
Well, there's no doubt that they have to try and attract some of that vote from National. That is the traditional home of the farmers. And so if they want to keep their vote where it is or go up in the vote, which is clearly what Winston wants to do, they're going to have to show that they are much more champions than the farmers and can actually do something about it. Because I imagine what the argument will be is National's not going to come back in. They, you know, can say all they want, but we're the only ones that actually can stop Labor from doing this to you. So I think we're going to see a lot more of that as we go into the next year. But I think at this stage, there still seems to be a sort of a want from Winston to make sure that it looks like a stable, cohesive government.
Mike, how far do you think they will push things?
Well, look, can I make a couple of points there? I wouldn't lay any store by all these New Zealand First people wanting to run in Wellington. If Bridget had ever run a political party, she would know that being a List MP based in Wellington is the most popular place to be. And I was repeatedly approached by List MPs who had very wonderful reasons why they needed to move to Wellington.
You don't have to travel as much, right?
Some of them got away with it.
Yeah.
Georgina Bayer was one of them. Look, I'd say this, that the provinces are not just farmers. And if you're looking at water, for example, the biggest case of water pollution causing fatalities was actually in the seat of Tukituki in Havelock North. So I think New Zealand First got to be a bit careful about this, but I do think if National is perceived to be weak, then the provinces are indeed happy hunting ground for them. And of course, Shane Jones is out there a lot announcing all these initiatives that arise from the Provincial Growth Fund. So, you know, this is a
whether
way
they're
building...
delivering on those initiatives, though, might be an interesting focus that comes on in 2019. Well, there's been the controversies over how little of the funds actually been spent. I don't know if we're going to see a big sudden impetus to things actually happening on the ground in 2020, but rather like Labor, people are going to want to say, what have we actually got out of the last 3 years based on those promises?
Well, let me speak personally and declare an interest. I mean, the Howard League runs a driving program for probationers who are on the way to jail that is funded by the Provincial Growth Fund. In the next 2 months, it will have 14 of these programs running around New Zealand. We are miles ahead of our target in terms of getting licences, and about half of these otherwise unemployable people are also getting jobs. So there's one huge success for you right off the top.
Yeah, but that's not stereotypical of the Provincial Growth Fund projects at this stage. I think
it was going to be dairy companies, and it was going to be waste to whatever companies on the West Coast. It was going to be big jobs.
And yeah, big factories and capital and all that sort of thing. And what I think we've seen is a huge amount of feasibility studies. I mean, ultimately, I think Shane Jones is looking for those feasibility studies to turn into ribbon-cutting announcements next year. But I think it's going to be really difficult to sell them as actual deliverables.
Let's have your take on coalition dynamics. We have talked about it a little previously. We saw some other examples of it recently. We've mentioned New Zealand First's stopping or watering down of several Labor initiatives. The kibosh on the capital gains tax is but one example. We then saw a couple of weeks ago the Greens got the treatment, with Labor rather brutally overturning the decision on the Waihi Mine, the two ministers overriding the Environment Minister. And then the Greens put their hand up last week and said, we can't agree with these changes on the Terrorism Suppression Act. Is that everyone happily and healthily occupying their niche in the coalition? Or are we going to see a growing pressure as people make their mark in election year, Mike?
Well, I think you will see more of that in election year. A party has got to define itself. I would say that the things we're looking at are actually quite mild. The extension to the Waihi mine, my understanding was that it was entirely underground, so it didn't really disturb the environment. And I think what we learnt from a election many years ago is that gold mining in that town is actually quite popular and generates a huge amount of work. I actually listened carefully to what Goldridge Garaman was saying on News Hub Nation about the terrorism bill, and I had to believe that Andrew Little's actually got it wrong. If what she said is correct, and we want to recognise another country's definition of terrorism in our own law, I wouldn't agree with that. That may not be the case. I might have got the wrong end of the stick. So, but I think it is an opportunity for, you know, parties to strut their stuff. And I think Goldridge Garaman made a real fist of her appearance on News Hub Nation on Saturday and Sunday. Well done.
Do you see compromises that will become fractures?
Not at this stage, I don't think. I think the Waihi mine is a good example, though, of, as Mike is right, in Waihi it's very, very popular. It basically underpins literally the entire town. So you see that kind of local economic need versus the sort of environmental ideology. And I think that's the type of discussion that will probably become more and more prominent going into next year. I think the terrorism bill is actually more of an example of Labor believing that they could rush a bit of legislation through and just assume that there was going to be support for it because it was anti-terrorism. And I think what we've actually seen is that there's been some good points raised by the Greens and some good points raised by National, actually about, is this the right, you know, have we got the right controls in place? Have we got the right thresholds in place? And so that's actually why MMP was brought in, to slow down and add this kind of discussion and accountability around legislation by the executive.
They're in their classic positions in that particular case. Some of the matters, I think the climate stuff is going to be really interesting, and what happens with water is going to be really interesting in 2020 as well, because Labor, which is the biggest party in this coalition, has also got to define itself ahead of 2020, and it's under pressure on a whole lot of fronts when it comes to policy delivery. There's been a lot of very sensible analysis that I've been reading about when you promise as big as you did, not thinking you're going to win an election. Of course, there's going to be pressure when you can't deliver. Kiwi Bill's the classic example. I was interested, however, in the piece I was reading about the weekend about the travel, the light rail in Auckland, and some of what has happened perhaps to delay that even getting its first sod turned. Mike, can you comment? Is this going to build up to be another attack point in 2020?
It could well be. And what you're seeing with light rail is a real development of the whole industry. And when you've got things like trackless light rail, which is immensely cheaper to install than the light rail with tracks, then it really does send you back to the drawing board. So I've got a bit of sympathy for Phil Twyford about this, because it looks as though we could get the kind of passenger quantities without laying tracks everywhere.
That Sunday Star Times article was brutal in its truth revealing, Mike. It talked about the fact that NZTA was all set to get going on this. It had lined up a whole bunch of private sector companies who had invested in building up their own talent pools with respect to this project. And at the last minute, to quote the Sunday Star Times, it looks like a six-page PowerPoint from the New Zealand Super Fund put a pause on everything. Is this going to turn out to be another headache for the government and possibly for the minister at just the wrong time?
Yeah, I think I read that article, and I think their interpretation was wrong. I think it's the dramatic change in technology that has stymied this. You've really got to go and look at what's new. It's like, you know, that when Germany reunified, they didn't bother putting wires in for the telephone system. They just moved straight to a cellular
system.
Who's
giving the advice on the trackless trains, which are also a subject of discussion in the capital as well, as it goes through its interminable, unresolved transport future? Same debates. We could be here forever waiting till we're all in flying unicycles, couldn't we?
Look,
but
I think
who's put that spanner in the works this far down when the government had promised this project to be underway by 2021, I think?
I think it's the Sydney City Council that's thrown its spanner in the works. They've actually got one of these things running, and everybody is looking at it all around the world to see, is this the answer for my particular public transport?
Your take on all this, Bridget?
Well, I think it's a little bit... I don't think it's truthful to say, you know, in 2 years suddenly we've had this massive technology change that has changed absolutely everything and thrown up every other plan. No doubt, if Sydney has just managed to actually put them in, that we knew about this technology before Labor promised it in the election. But they promised light rail. They've had chances to, you know, investigate, put the business case together, get those competitive tenders, and that clearly hasn't happened. And I think that's, you know, reflective of a number of sort of issues where Labor made sort of these headline policies. You know, it's the Kiwi Build Again.
It's government
and not
by working group, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. Well, also making that kind of headline policy announcement about a promise of an outcome without understanding the competitive.
They were stuck with that in some ways because they were trying to win an election they didn't think they could win. And I don't want to excuse it entirely by that. If you put up a portfolio you can't deliver, a manifesto you can't deliver on, that's your problem. The question is whether you should have adjusted expectations straight away afterwards.
And that's what my argument is on this light rail issue, that immediately you should have gone and gone down the work and gone, actually, there's other options out there for delivering the outcome that we have sought, and we should have been moving on that. To get 2 years down the track, or non-track, and get to this point where you have done nothing, I don't think that's excusable.
What of the, just briefly touch on the polls, I think we're up to the two-year anniversary of the government around about now, might be at the weekend. And it's pertinent to our conversation because up till 2 years you can say we've got our working groups reporting back, or we're getting to grips with being government, or we're lining up ducks to do all sorts of things. After 2 years, people are starting to say, okay, what have we got? What are you even on track to delivering that you said you were going to deliver, whether it's housing or poverty reduction or transport? It gets gnarly from now on, going into an election year. What do we make of what has happened in the polls? We didn't touch on the TV3 poll last week because it was clearly correcting from a rogue. The next day we had a Colmar Brunton that pretty much lined, wasn't too far off. What do you make of both of them showing a decline for Labor and support for the Prime Minister, Bridget?
Well, I think it definitely shows a trend. I never think you want to look at a poll in isolation, and we know that the polls in the last few years haven't been the sort of accurate predictors that they have been in the past. So there's definitely a decline, and I think you've seen those last couple of months of that sort of shakiness in the government, and it also becoming more attached to Jacinda as well. We previously had her sort of sitting above some of the mess, but now I think the Me Too stuff, the year of delivery, her being really held to account on that, it's actually attaching to her brand more and more.
Mike?
Well, I'm a bit jumpy about polls because, as I said in a piece I wrote for Hawke's Bay today, they're no longer comparable with each other. The News Hub Read Research poll is now polling online as well as landlines. The Colmar Brunton is randomly generating cell phone numbers. The only one that is stuck with pure landlines is the Labor Party's own UMR poll, which still has Labor a bit ahead of National and New Zealand First over the hurdle. So, and that is what the government will be trusting. So I think it's very interesting. We are looking at a whole lot of different technologies. One of them will be right, and only the election will tell us which.
Which is why you can't afford to have close results if you want to be sure of winning anymore. I think every major election of the last 3 years has thrown that up. What it does show is both National and Labor basically in pretty strong positions. One has more friends than the other, potentially. And it shows the support parties, Greens, New Zealand First, both pretty steadily within reach of the 5% or over it. So what it shows basically is a contest. What Labor will not want, even out of polls we don't 100% trust, is a trend of it coming down, Bridget.
Yeah, absolutely. And going into an election as well, you want that ability to argue that people need to come out to vote as well. So actually having it sort of close and not just a sweep, you know, towards Labor is actually kind of good in some ways for Labor from the polls. I think you can see that in the local body elections here in Wellington. Justin Lester, the Labor candidate or independent, depending on whether you're the Prime Minister or not. But he, you know, there was this kind of, I think, an inertia here that everyone just thought that he would come back in. And I think that probably in some ways led to a lower turnout because people didn't come out to vote because they just thought it was a done deal.
Interesting one. Just finally, the Labour headwinds possibly ahead, and we were just flagging it really. It's by 2020, people will be saying what out of that manifesto is actually delivered, what has been watered down, and what is looking like the never never. But you wanted to talk about the immigration minister's decision last week and how this blew up. This was the repeat drink driver whom he granted residency to, just correct me if I'm wrong, on the basis that he couldn't return to his home country. He was a protected person. Your point on it, Mike Williams?
Well, it was a bizarre, misbegotten attack by Simon Bridges, and it only lasted for about an hour, but he seemed to want to stick with it. Now, this guy cannot be deported, although he has historic drunk driving charges that go back, I don't think he's been caught for 10 years. And there's some sort of international treaty which protects him, which means we can't deport him. Now, the key point about this is that National ministers twice extended his visa. So, you know, it was the copper calling the kettle black.
And, well, they rolled the visa over as opposed to granting him residency.
Well, you know, that surely saved money. I mean, if you can't do anything other than keep him here, you might as well stop this ridiculous charade of, you know, rolling it over again and again.
You're being so practical, Mike. Did they win politically? Did they get a day's swipe in?
I think they did.
I seriously think Simon Bridges ended up with eagle over his face.
I completely disagree, because, I mean, the number one thing this did is just bring up again the immigration minister's poor decision-making in this place. They want to come back and, replay and remind people about that Shrewbrook decision. Like, that is perfect politics. And, of course, they're going to take every chance to remind them of that.
In that case, it brought up a National minister's poor decision-making as well.
He was going to roll it over to the guy we were at his funeral. I think that was National's plan, as opposed to making him a resident and a citizen of the future in this fine country. I think that was what it came down to. But it was an easy hit. And honestly, Bridget, I can't help but think the narrative of 2020 when we come to this campaign is going to be all these micro videos. We are going to see this new way of campaigning migrate very heavily into our election campaign, targeting of people's social media with these little hits and bites. And if those parties aren't geared up to navigate those waters, they're going to be in trouble. If what we saw in Australia was anything to go by, would that be your observation?
Yeah, I think so, because I think we're recognising that people are not necessarily getting their information about politics anymore through the traditional media outlets, and so you have to, you know, deliver it to where they literally are, and in contestable kind of way.
Some of what we saw in Australia was not factually accurate. but it worked.
Well, some would argue that what is put out by traditional media outlets is not always...
A death tax.
Yeah, but we saw, like, even
from the
if
double taxation alterations they were going to make.
Yeah, but if you go back 3 years before that, Labor ran on a Medicare campaign, and that wasn't factually accurate either, and they didn't run it by social media. So I don't think you can blame the social media medium as the issue with political parties taking, you know...
It's not a question of blame. It's a question of saying, and we also, don't forget, this is in the context now of the Speaker and National having settled their standoff over the ads involving the parliamentary video, and now everyone's going to decide what the new rules are and everyone's going to play nicely and get that resolved. You're in a medium where you can do an awful lot and not really without the middle person being your favourite media outlet fact-checking or pointing stuff out. It is a whole new ball game on where we've been before.
There's a very interesting snippet in Winston Peters' speech where he points out that Simon Bridges has more social media advisers than he has policy advisers.
I think that it might be just some inaccurate reading of the staffing list.
My point exactly. Thanks, both of you, Bridget Mills and Mike Williams.